Here's Andy Udman.
Pam, what are you saying? That our food could be a lot more delicious and nutritious if...
Yes, we would see better quality food, better tasting food, if we could have access to more farm fresh food. Unfortunately, today, because of government regulations, it's very difficult for consumers to find or have access to this delicious, nutritious farm fresh food. And so what's happening is consumers are frustrated on the one hand because they have limited access to this food, and on the other hand, farmers are frustrated because of government over-regulation.
This is your captain speaking. Fasten your seatbelts. Pam Colleen is in, so we are in for turbulence. I want to ask you a question this morning, folks. Did you have breakfast this morning? Good. Did you have bacon and eggs? Good. Here's a question. How old was the egg that you ate? How old was the egg that you ate? When I was a kid, we went to the chicken house and got the egg and had it 3-4 hours after it was laid. Today, Pam Colleen, did you have breakfast? Did you have eggs for breakfast?
I sure did. You know what? I have a local farmer who gave me those eggs actually just 2 days ago.
Oh, you cheated. You cheated. Folks, think about it. We're going to talk about food this hour, and I think you will be shocked. Pam, we were just talking during the news about food. When I was a kid, a tomato. Mm-hmm. I used to love a tomato. I didn't need salt. I didn't need sugar. I didn't need... It tasted so good.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful,
it just
sweet.
Seems
mm-hmm.
to me today that food is bland.
Yes, it's bland today. And unfortunately, our children are not going to know the difference. What they're going to taste today, they're going to think is real food. But you and I remember back in the 60s or 70s, Andy, that we actually did have access to some real food back then. And the taste of it was far better then than it is now. Unfortunately, our kids aren't going to know that, of course.
A friend of mine had some friends over recently, and he was cooking steaks. And he was so proud of these steaks. Mm-hmm. And a teenager who was visiting took one of the steaks and reached for the ketchup bottle. And my friend Rich said, if you touch that bottle, I'm going to have to kill you. But with the way food tastes today, salt and ketchup are essential.
Yeah, you have to add flavoring to the food today because it is so bland. And, you know, there's a big difference between local food where the animals have been pastured versus these factory farmed foods. And a lot of people, maybe they look the same, Andy. They do. They can look very similar. But underneath the surface, you have to ask yourself what's happening in that food in terms of the nutrition. And then even more so, which is really, really important to consumers, is the taste.
We will make our listeners really angry this hour if we don't keep the phone lines open. So, folks, the phone lines are open. If you want to weigh in, we have a very special guest this morning, written an article in the Globe and Mail just a few days ago. Let me read you the opening paragraph. Two chicken inspectors showed up at a farm in southern Ontario not long ago. They flashed badges and inspected the premises, and sure enough, they found what they were looking for. Chickens. About 100 of them wandering around open pastures, pecking at bugs, worms, and blades of grass. The inspectors quickly put a stop to all of that. Why would they do that, Pam?
Oh, it has to do with the chicken police and the chicken police. Yeah.
Would you introduce our guest?
Our guest today is Mark Schatzker, and he's an award-winning food and travel writer and author of a book called Steak: One Man's Search for the World's Tastiest Piece of Beef. And he's a man after my own heart because his favorite beef is from a grass-fed cow.
Mark, how are you this morning?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Have you had blowback to your article?
A little bit. Most of it was actually very positive, so that felt good. But there's always some blowback.
Mark, you raise a good point. Attitudes are starting to change about what Pam and I have just been discussing, and people are starting to ask questions about where did this food come from?
Yes, there's definitely been an awakening. People are just a lot more interested about where their food comes from, and that knowledge of, you know, that whole food system is getting deeper and deeper, which is a good thing for sure.
Paint the picture of what we're eating today, Mark.
Well, with respect to chicken, we're eating essentially factory farm chicken. It's a breed called a White Rock. It's a hybrid, a high-performing hybrid. It was developed in the 1950s. It gets fat extremely quickly. 50, 80 years ago, a chicken took about 20 weeks to get to roaster size. We've got it down to 6 weeks now. They live indoors. They get a very high-protein diet of soy and corn, usually GMO. And it's just not very interesting chicken. The thing that's interesting about Canada is that chicken, along with eggs and dairy and turkey, is supply managed, which is to say, if you go out tomorrow and buy a farm and decide you want to raise the world's most delicious chickens, you're not allowed to do that. It's against the law.
So it discriminates against the small mixed farm, is what you're saying. So the regulations, the policies that are in place right now are favorable to big business or big food, but it's difficult for a small farmer to start in.
Yeah, I mean, the price to get into the system is extremely high. It's prohibitive. I mean, it's just, you know, the minimum in Ontario, the minimum number of quota units to buy is 14,000. It costs something like $1.5 million just to get in the game. And then you're talking about, I think it works out to about 90,000 birds a year. So anyone who's going to get into that, let's say they want to pasture 500 or 1,000 birds just to start out. I mean, who's going to start doing 90,000 birds a year?
Why is that wrong, Mark?
Because it limits the freedom of people to farm and to engage in this, you know, millennia-old bucolic practice. But it also is, it just doesn't let the little guy break in. Not everybody has access to capital. Rich people have access to capital, but not middle-class people, not poor people. And, you know, people talk about supply management. This is always the argument you hear, is that it supports the little guy, it supports the small farmer. I know lots of small farmers, and they can't make a living from their farms because they're not allowed to raise chickens. They're not allowed to, I mean, they're allowed to raise chickens for personal consumption, but they're not allowed to market them. They're not allowed to raise eggs and market them. What's the point of having a farm if you can't farm?
Now, but a lot of city folks have trouble wrapping their minds around some of these, like the supply management issues, but the bottom line is this. The food we're getting, not delicious, not nutritious.
Yes, that would be my assessment, absolutely.
And what's happening today in terms of consumer demand? Do you see a rush for people? Do you see an increase in demand for people going out and trying to find this food?
No question. And when you look at the sectors where it is a bit freer, when you look at things like growing fruit and vegetables or beef and pork, there's just a lot of diversity. You go to farmers market, there's lots of small farmers raising pork. They're doing all sorts of things. You can get milk-fed pork. You can get apple-fed pork. You can get older hogs that are great for sausages. You can get younger ones that are great for those beautiful, tender pork chops. There's lots of heritage vegetables and heirloom tomatoes and fruits. But when you look at the sectors that are managed, it comes in two flavors, you know, organic and factory. And the organic stuff is, you know, kind of often organic in name, but not that cheery pictures of birds singing and grass growing that everyone has in their head.
Of the foods we eat, Mark, which are the ones affected the most along the lines that you've just suggested? I would think dairy and eggs.
I would say chicken and eggs. There's a little bit of diversity in dairy, but not as much as there needs to be, not by a long shot.
Okay, now tell me why this is a bad thing. I went to an open house / open barn recently, a new dairy barn near Aylmer, over 200 cattle, and the farmers there were doing some mental calculations about the investment. They figured the investment in the barn and the equipment was about $3 million. The license, just the license, called the quota, to produce this milk was probably two or three times that, in the range of $9-10 million.
Yeah, it's about $27,000 per cow, not to buy the cow, but just for the right to sell that milk.
Okay, now, what we're hearing is that Stephen Harper may change that, correct?
Apparently, they're thinking about it. I don't think because they have a fantasy of buying farm-fresh eggs and pastured dairy. Maybe they have a little bit of that, but I think it's because there's a lot of pressure on Canada to get rid of supply management for trade reasons.
You mean Stephen Harper doesn't buy farm-fresh eggs?
I don't know. I honestly don't know.
His wife is a farm girl, so, you know.
Maybe they do. I don't want to say that he's against that. I just simply don't know. But my sense is that the motivation there has to do more with international trade than it does, agricultural freedom for foodies.
Okay, Mark, I'm going to ask you to give me a zinger. Just as we go into the break here, why do we need to change the current system? You've suggested the food we're eating is not delicious, it is not nutritious, and then there's the price of a pound of Gouda in London compared to what it is an hour away in Port Huron.
It's expensive. That's the dairy and eggs, which is a staple food, something very important to feed all our children, is expensive. And this is particularly onerous on poor people because, an $8 block of cheddar cheese, which isn't uncommon to see in the supermarket, if you're making minimum wage, that's almost an hour's worth of work.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they're soon going to be selling cheese by the slice, it's that expensive.
Yeah.
Folks, the lines are open, 643-1290, especially if you're on the farm. I know that I have a relative near Exeter who has a chicken farm. I have a friend near Aylmer who has a dairy farm. They are scared to death about what Stephen Harper's planning. I want to ask Mark why. In just a moment, right here on London Today, on News Talk 1290, CJBK. Interesting title for a book, Steak. One man's search for the world's tastiest piece of beef. Author Mark Schatzker in conversation with Pam Colleen and myself this morning. Mark, did you ever find that tasty piece of beef, number one? And number two, was it good Canadian beef or not?
Yes, and yes, but not all. I was lucky enough to find some extremely, extraordinarily, life-changingly good beef. I found some in Scotland, some in Argentina, some in the United States, and I've also found some in Canada. In fact, I got a wonderful email from a rancher in BC who said, your book totally changed my approach to ranching, and as a way of saying thanks, he sent me two standing rib roasts, which was unbelievable.
You have friends in all the right places, Mark.
Absolutely.
Okay, life-changingly good beef. What was the secret?
The secret is what the cow eats. Simply put, the more grass they eat, the more flavor there will be in the steak. And the easiest way to illustrate that is if you're ever in a field, just step out, grab a clump of grass, put it in your mouth, chew it, then spit it out. You won't be able to swallow it. It's very flavorful. It's like a really peppery, intense arugula. Now, what we tend to get cattle fat on is corn. Go get some feed corn, make porridge of that and taste it, and you will taste nothing. It's like glue. The feed has an effect on the animal that's eating it. We are what we eat, and we also are what the animals that we eat. So that's the simplest way of putting it. That's not to say, just to be clear on this, that all grass-fed beef is good. Getting cattle fat on grass is very tricky. It's like making Pinot Noir wine. If you don't know what you're doing, it'll be terrible. If you do know what you're doing, it'll be a drug-like experience.
Mm-hmm. And it's relative to the breed as well, isn't it, Mark?
It has something to do with breed, and it has a lot to do with soil and grass and pasture management, which is a big, big, big one.
Pam made a good point earlier. She said kids today don't know what good food tastes like.
Yeah, I agree. I think a lot of adults don't. This has been happening for a long time, and it's just a very slow drip. The flavor just been slowly, slowly, slowly leached out of our food, and you don't notice it. You just, over time, you start... You know, why is it that at some point we all started getting steak rubs for our steaks and marinating them and just trying to figure out why it was that the meat that we were eating just didn't seem to have enough flavor, so we were reaching for it? And it's happened slowly over time, and that's why we haven't noticed it.
Now, this thing with marbling, this is one thing that really kind of irks me, is that people are going to say, oh, I had the most beautiful marbled beef today, and this is something that has been designed through this corn feeding system that people think is superior somehow or another. But you can get that wonderful effect, too, from a grass-fed piece of beef as well.
No question. You can do it on grass. It takes longer, and it takes more skill. I mean, the reason we all focus on marbling is because the USDA brought out its quality grades in 1926, and Canada essentially follows the American system, and it rewarded fat. They didn't start looking for marbling until the 1960s, but in 1926, almost all cattle were raised on grass. Something like, in the 30s, it was something like 5% were coming off feed. So it was a totally, and by feed, I mean grain. So it was a totally different system. But what we figured out how to do in the intervening decades is cheat. We, instead of getting cattle fat on grass, we just give them a whole bunch of corn, and we do the same thing with all our livestock. We intensively feed them essentially protein and carbs. We don't worry about any of the other things. You know, we give them just enough vitamins to sort of keep them alive, but we're not thinking about all the other, organic chemicals, for lack of a better word, that exists in food in nature. We've sort of stripped those out, and the food we're eating as a result is, you know, it looks like food, it feels like food, but it doesn't taste like food.
I started this segment by talking about your article and the chicken inspectors, the chicken police showing up in this farm in southwestern Ontario, an Amish farm, and the inspectors quickly put a stop to these, what would you call them, free-range chickens. Why would they do that?
Because they had reason to believe these chickens were being sold off the farm. This is a tricky point, and some people have tried to fault me on this. You are technically allowed in Ontario to raise 300 chickens, up to. You can't raise any over that in one calendar year. But here's the thing. You're not allowed to sell them anywhere other than the farm. You can't market them. So for people who live on a farm, I mean, most farms aren't very close to cities. What good does that do you? What good does that do me in the city? I can't drive 2 hours away every time I want an interesting chicken. So I don't see that as being anything other than an illustration of how incredibly tight and unfair the rules are.
Should consumers care about this?
They should absolutely care. I mean, they should care, I think, in the moral grounds that it's just not fair to do this to farmers, the farmers that don't have quota. But also, more importantly, they should have more choice in the food they eat. You know, I spoke to chicken farmers of Ontario. I'm interested in pastured chicken. I find it has a lot more flavor, and I think it's nutritionally better. When you talk to them, they just say no one's interested in that. No one has the slightest interest in that. And I think that illustrates the degree to which they're insensitive to demand. I mean, if you look at chicken from the kind of the corporate industrial point of view, yeah, you want to raise chickens to sell to Swiss Chalet or Kentucky Fried Chicken. And this growing, you know, body of people who are interested in food raised by small farmers, at this point is small. It's not a big market compared to the mass produced stuff, but it's growing. But they're just not really interested in that. They think it's crazy. When you say, you know, I'm interested in eating a chicken that's been out there eating grass and bugs and worms, they think you're nuts. They think, no, we keep our chickens indoors where they always have access to water and they're warm, and we feed them soybeans and corn. And that for them is a good thing. I just totally see it differently than they do.
Mark, we're coming down to the bottom of the hour. We have to take a short break for a news update, but I am fascinated by the growing evidence that Pam keeps bringing in every week that we are, number one, fatter, sicker, and more depressed than ever. We've all bought the concept that the solution to that is pumping products from Big Pharma into our arms or into our foods or whatever. And she is suggesting that we could cure so much of what ails us by changing our nutritional habits. I want to ask you about that when we come back. Again, the phone lines are open, 643-1290, right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK. 10:33 now on this Thursday morning. Pam Kalina in studio this morning. We're talking about supply management is the technical term, but it's a control of the production of the food that you and I eat, and it impacts you and I in a major way. We're in conversation with author Mark Schatzker, wrote an article in the Globe and Mail a few days ago, about this whole subject. Mark, I want to tell you, this is a very personal issue for me, not so much because I was raised on a farm, but I'm picturing right now a farm near Dresden, a friend of mine who has been in the pork industry for years and years. At the one end of the spectrum, we have supply management, this dairy barn near Aylmer, for example, where they've got millions tied up in a quota, which is basically a license to sell your product. Then we've got the pork industry, where this beautiful, huge pork barn is sitting empty with a few sheep in one end, because the pork industry is in shambles in this country because too many farmers got into it. Both extremes are wrong. Is there a happy medium we could find somewhere?
I would like to think there is. I am not an agricultural policy specialist, so you know that it's always easier to criticize systems than it is to create new ones or to create solutions that will make everybody happy. But I suppose my response would be that the system we have now isn't working, and there are problems with it that need to be addressed. And yes, we have to address what the consequences can be.
But in other countries, Mark, other countries have gotten rid of the quota system, and how are they today?
From what I know, New Zealand is probably the example I know the best. They got rid of their quota system in the early 80s, and from what I understand, they're doing very, very well. They export a great deal of dairy to Asia, to the point that their system's almost entirely pasture-based, to the point that it's actually getting hard for people to find pasture land to grow sheep and to grow cattle, beef cattle, because their dairy industry is doing so incredibly well.
Now, what do the Americans say about our quota system? Do they even understand it?
They shake their heads in bewilderment. When Americans come over the border to buy, and they happen to buy milk or eggs, they're shocked by the price. And when you talk to people in agriculture in the States, they just can't even believe it. They're a little bit more, perhaps, sensitive to government interference, so that probably has something to do with their response, but they just can't believe it.
I want to throw this question out to our audience. Do you buy your cheese here, or do you go across the border? Because if you buy a bit of a supply across the border, it is well worth your while to go an hour west across the border at Sarnia just to buy your dairy products. What do you have a figure, Mark, how much more expensive cheese is in Canada per pound, for example, than it is just an hour away west of Sarnia?
No, I don't. In fact, but I haven't focused on that line of argument. I mean, I think it's important, but my passion is flavor, and that's really how I come at the supply management issue, is just from the point of view of agricultural diversity.
Well, there's three issues here. A food that is raised on a factory farm, not delicious, not nutritious, and it can cost so much more. Each one of those reasons, Mark, is a reason to be concerned about this issue.
Yes.
Now, I see chefs, top chefs here in Canada, who are fighting for this cause, if you will. And I really commend them for their support on this issue. Can you talk about some of the chefs and what they're saying about this system and what they might be doing to support a change?
Well, they're disgusted by it. They're incredibly frustrated. And it's really, you know, we all take pride in our country, and especially people who are interested in food. We want the restaurants in London and Toronto and Montreal to be every bit as good as the restaurants in New York and Paris. And our hands are really tied by some of this policy. Some of the restrictive policy has to do with, you know, health inspections and so forth, but a lot of it is just getting ingredients. If you want to get really good eggs, these restaurants are sometimes investigated. People come in looking to see if the eggs look, you know, if they're multicolored, for example, because that means they came out of a small hen house, and that means they're not legal. And they're extraordinarily frustrated by this, because if you're a chef, let's say you're trying to make the ultimate chicken and dumplings or the ultimate chicken stock to use in a restaurant, you want to get one of these heritage birds that has some age on it so you can infuse some flavor into your broth. That's just not available.
Let's go to the phones. Rick, you have a comment.
Yes, I'd like to talk about the eggs. I buy eggs from a friend who gets them from a farm that supplies. They're like a day old when I get them, and the difference between them and the store-bought is just incredible. Like, they're so good.
I agree.
He told me that the ones in the store could be up to 6 to 8 weeks old. Is that true?
Mark?
My understanding is that the eggs in the store isn't so much a freshness issue. You know, one good way to tell is when you boil an egg. If you ever have trouble getting a shell off an egg, it's because it's a very fresh egg, and there hasn't had time for the interior of the egg to shrink away from the shell, to put it simply. So I don't think there's a freshness issue with the eggs in the stores. I just think there's a quality issue in terms of, you know, those eggs coming out of high-performing factory barns where there just isn't any flavor.
Rick, we've been talking about the difference in nutrition and the lack of a delicious taste. Make us salivate for just a moment. How good are these farm-fresh eggs?
They puff right up when you call there. You wouldn't believe it. And another thing I get from them is chickens. And I'm talking chickens that are 9 to 10 pounds. I pay $20 for them. I've got it's like cooking a small turkey. And they're so flavorful. And what really gets me is we used to get them at one of the grocery stores. They're these little small things that shrink in the oven. They collapse. And here's a little food for thought, Andy. These farms that are growing these chickens grow them so fast these days with growth hormone or whatever they've got in them. So you are what you eat. So if you're eating one of these chickens with growth hormone, is it not aging you quicker?
Yeah, you are what they ate, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
I like that. You are what they ate. Sounds like a song. But Pam, we had some figures earlier this hour about how long it used to take to take a chicken until it was time to go to market and what it takes now.
Yeah, it takes about, I guess, 42 days is what I understand. And typically it should take about 122 days to fully grow a chicken.
Exactly. We've just sped it right up. Now, from my understanding, we don't give our chickens hormones, but we've bred them that they're more hormonally active. So the hormones are coming from within the chicken, but it's still, you know, a hyper-fast-growing chicken. The analogy people often use, they say the equivalent in humans would be a four-year-old who weighs 250 pounds.
Ooh, ouch.
So you're a farm-fresh kind of guy, Rick.
Oh, I love it. I'm out Delaware way, and I wouldn't do anything. I buy my asparagus out here. I buy my vegetables out here. Everything. Anything we can get from the farmers out here, we buy out here.
Okay, so you don't come to the grocery stores in London?
No, I wouldn't. I don't buy beef in London at all. It's just not the same. I have friends that just, you know, I will split on a cow.
And tell me you don't put ketchup on your steaks.
I don't put ketchup on it. And I might put a little Montreal steak spice on there once in a while, and that's about it.
Well, there's a man who's singing your song, Pam. Thank you so much, Rick.
Thank you.
Okay.
Now, now, Mark, sometimes there's a greater demand than supply. What happens in that case here in Canada?
In terms of?
When there's not enough eggs, perhaps. I mean, where are we going to get our chicken eggs and other
foods?
Yeah,
we actually bring in some chicken eggs from the States because we constrict our supply.
But doesn't that break quota right there? Isn't that?
I think they've made some allowance for that. It basically lets them more effectively manage the market. Mm-hmm. They want to keep supply as tight as they can because that's how you get the highest price. But then when you get something like Christmas or Easter when everybody wants eggs, you got to get them from somewhere.
Now back to the story you told in your Globe and Mail article about the Amish. What are the regulations with respect to the Amish who like to grow things about as natural as you can? Are they allowed to sell on the open market?
No, I think they face the same rules as everybody else. They can grow them for themselves up to 300, but they can't bring them to a farmer's market or sell them to a restaurant or a butcher shop.
Mm-hmm. And we talked earlier about the farm as our true pharmacy, where we really should be getting our medicine. You know, a lot of people are learning about the nutritional differences between these foods from pastured animals. Can you speak to that?
There's just a lot more in them. They eat a lot more grass, and there's many, many more nutrients, micronutrients in grass that you don't get in these processed feeds. And that shows up in the meat. You can taste it, mm-hmm. and it also, the nutritional profile is different.
Absolutely.
My own experience is that you feel better when you eat these foods. It just seems more sensible. I mean, it tastes better, and that's what drives me. And this is really, really important, because I don't think you can talk about health food unless you talk about flavor, because we are driven by our taste buds and by our stomach, and it's just, for most people, it's not pleasant to eat food that doesn't taste good.
When you see the growing focus on the 100-mile diet, the growing focus and appreciation for local farmers' markets, do you think we're going to see legislation to follow this, Mark?
I would really hope so. The problem is there's some really powerful players. And I want to be, you know, when we brought in supply management, I think the motives were good. We were trying to bring some stability to the agricultural sector so farmers weren't getting hammered by gluts and falls in prices. But I think it's turned into one of these things where the legislation is really old, hasn't kept up with the times, and we've created an entitled class, dairy farmers and chicken farmers and egg farmers, who are sitting on millions and millions and millions of dollars in quota. And there's some big multinational players who, you know, processors and so forth, that nobody wants anything to change. And I think it needs to change.
But consumers are going to drive that change, aren't they?
I hope they will, but the government isn't always sensitive to what consumers want. And they put out their own stories. You know, when supply management comes up, the story is always this protects the small farmer, and there's this fear of American-style corporate farming, which I would argue we already have on a small scale.
Okay, now I'm gonna try to get this phrase past my lips, but it's going to half kill me to do it. Food from China.
Yes.
I've said on this show, I wouldn't lick a stamp that came from China, given some of their lack of regulations and concern for some of the issues here in North America. I can't imagine anybody eating anything from China, especially after their, what was it they were putting in?
Well, there's the melamine and the malachite green and other issues. Foods that have been coming from China have been contaminated, yes.
Absolute poison that they were putting in their children's milk. And yeah, apparently somebody was executed for doing it, but it's the kind of horror story we keep hearing out of China. Some would say that it's the supply management in Canada that's protecting us from that cheap food from China.
I don't think the two have anything to do with each other. If we're concerned as a country about the quality of food coming in from another country, we don't have to bring it in. I'll give you the example of Europe, because I know a lot about beef, because I wrote a book about steak. Europe imports a lot of beef because it's a small area with a high population. They do not allow beef that has been treated with antibiotics or hormones. So this shuts off a large amount of U.S. beef that's produced that way. But they say, if you produce that beef without antibiotics or hormones, we're happy to buy it. And guess what? They do. So we can do the same thing. We can tweak our agricultural policy to keep out the stuff we don't like. I don't think supply management has anything to do with that. That's trade policy.
Years ago, I remember an absolute horror story from the Philippines where they have very few regulations and they were growing beef, and they suddenly noticed that, you know, little girls were growing breasts at the age of 6, and they traced it to some of the growth hormones they were using on their cattle. Are those horror stories gone, Mark, or are they still lingering?
Well, we still use what, you know, the industry calls growth promotants. The science linking that to a direct effect in the body is tenuous at best. The thing is, when hormones get into your stomach, they tend to get you know, destroyed by the acid and so forth. But what we don't know is the effect of the low dose. So it's a question that hasn't been fully answered. But, you know, as someone who eats this food and someone who has kids, it, you know, I find it alarming. It's better not to find out the hard way.
643-1290, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back with author Mark Schatzker in just a moment, an award-winning author and travel writer. Great chance to talk about your food. Love the call earlier about how nutritious the food is from the vegetable gardens around Delaware. And our caller saying he certainly wouldn't go to the grocery stores in London to buy any food which he can buy from the local fields around Delaware. Love to hear your story, 643-1290, when we come back in just a moment here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK. I had a suspicion that Ryan was going to go for that song. We're in conversation with award-winning author and food and travel writer Mark Schatzker. Is that the solution, Mark? We go back to Old MacDonald's farm?
Yes, that is the solution.
Yeah, and the real way to do that is by increasing our demand for these foods, correct?
Yes, and the important thing, too, is we also have to influence consumers. It's really easy to beat up on processors and just, you know, point the finger at the government. I think with respect to supply management, we can rightfully point the finger at the government and say that's bad policy. But when it comes to eating higher quality food, the thing we have to stop doing as consumers and is shopping for the cheapest food. This is stuff you put in your body. It might be okay to buy, you know, a cheap bicycle or a cheap kite or something, but when you put something in your body, that you live with that forever.
Absolutely. Let's go to the phone. Steve, your comment. Steve?
Hello.
Talk to me.
I'm not going to deny that grass-fed cattle may be more flavorful, but where do your guests think they're going to find enough for grassland to finish the number of cattle at the speed that we need to finish them to satisfy the demands for the populace?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is going to be a gradual change, Steve. And when I drive out in the country, I do see a lot of open land. But again, this is, you're right. This is something that's going to take a gradual change. It can't happen overnight. It would be unrealistic.
Well, but also, where do you think grain?
Steve,
whether it takes place over a long period of time, you can't deny that there has to be a tremendous amount of grassland to be able to fill the demand.
Steve, let me get
at this time of year, generally there is no grassland. So how do you foresee feeding these cattle all winter long?
Mark, go for it.
Okay, very simple. In the winter, you feed them hay. You can also feed them silage. And as far as where do you get your grassland, that's all the land we're using right now to grow grain. The Midwest, Alberta, Saskatchewan, that's grass prairie. I mean, that's where grass grew, and that's where grass can grow.
Steve, appreciate your call. Let's go to Rick. Rick, go ahead.
Yeah, several different issues on this thing. One, I'm not disagreeing with you, but the supply management issue is a totally different issue than what the consumer wants. If the consumer wants it, and if he wants it bad enough, we will supply it. The problem is there's not enough people that want it.
Mm-hmm.
The supply management issue is... Well, that could go on for days, but part of the problem is farmers have invested millions in good faith for a system that we've, you know, had in place for years. How do you go about to phase that out? Do you do it overnight?
Rick, that's a very interesting question. Mark, I've read a little bit about this. I understand in New Zealand or Australia that the government has literally bought out some of these quotas, but that'd be horribly expensive.
Well, it would, but I mean, it's horribly expensive as it is in terms of the price we're paying. I don't think the farmers should be shafted on this. I don't think it would be fair to have somebody in good faith buy quota and then find that it was worthless overnight. That would not be fair, and I wouldn't support that. So, however it's done, it should be, we need to be sensitive to these things.
Rick, are you a farmer? Are you a farmer?
Yes, I am. I am. And the farm fresh issue, as far as eggs and stuff like that, part of this comes in is we have to start with the law change, because if somebody goes to that Mennonite or Amish fella and buys those eggs and comes up with salmonella, who's he going after? The government and that Amish farmer. Where, you know, we need to put more responsibility back on ourselves. If you go buy those eggs or buy those products, you face the consequences if there's an issue with them. But you see, people are scared to death to sell anything because, you know, they'll lose everything just because there could be some issue with a quality problem. Now, be it that there isn't an issue with the supply management, I'm just saying there's a protection system in place there.
Rick, let me just ask you quickly before we let you go. I don't know about your own. What do you produce on your farm?
We're a large dairy farmer and cash crop.
Okay. You worried about losing your quota?
Not overnight, no. And is quota change? Part of the problem, the supply management system works. Do we need changes? Yes. Lower our tariffs? Yes. But, like, it does work because you got to remember the American system and the Canadian system, we supply, none of the taxpayers pay to get rid of the excess milk if there's overproduction. And the supply management system didn't make the farmer insufficient. It makes the processor, because the processor doesn't have to worry about getting rid of the extra whey and stuff where the states they do.
Rick, we have to leave it there.
And the problem is, we get it out of the market. We don't ask the taxpayers to pay anything for subsidies. When was the last time a dairy farmer came to the government and asked for help?
Okay. Rick, I appreciate the call so much. We're almost out of time. Rick, summarize it for us and put a little bow on it.
Mark.
Okay.
Mark, I'm sorry.
The one, I will disagree. He says there's not enough demand. There is demand. The problem is that with the onerous cost of quota, if you want to raise one of these heritage chickens, the thing's going to cost $30 by the time you get it to market. But there's no question there is demand. I mean, if one person wants it, there is demand. And a lot more than one person. There's lots of people out there. So I definitely disagree with that.
Mm-hmm. What about exemptions as part of a solution?
You know, perhaps that's something that people should look at. But the only thing is there's this argument that supply management is good because there's never a government bailout. There is a constant and ongoing bailout every time you go to the grocery store. So I don't follow that logic. The money's coming from somewhere. And I don't think it necessarily follows that if we get rid of supply management, there's bailouts. Mm-hmm. I think we need to work towards a solution. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of the arguments put forward in favor of supply management just don't ring true for me.
Okay, what do we watch for in the coming weeks and months on this issue, Mark?
I hope there's just growing pressure, growing demand, and that the government is sensitive, that they realize that there are problems and that something needs to be done, and that the status quo.
Are you working on any new books or articles on the subject?
I'm working. You know, we've talked a lot about the relationship of flavor and nutrition, and that's something that's very interesting to me. And I think it's we have to let these products be available. You know, a good example is pure pastured milk. We have organic milk in Canada. A lot of people want milk from cattle that don't eat anything other than grass or perhaps hay in the winter. That's just not available. And it's just very frustrating to me that it's not, because that's milk that I would like to feed to my kids. Mm-hmm. And why can't I?
Are you you're a raw milk guy?
No, not raw necessarily. You can pasteurize pastured milk if you want. I mean, raw is a separate issue, and we can talk about that as well. But I just don't think it's fair that we can't get this. There's farmers who want to grow it. There's consumers who want to consume it.
Well,
why can't we connect those dots?
Let's leave it right there. Mark, been a real pleasure. We thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you very much.
Mark Schatzker is an award-winning author. His article recently in the Globe and Mail.
And his book, Steak, One Man's Search for the World's Tastiest Piece of Beef.
Pam, you have a couple of things coming up.
Yes, I'm going to be speaking at Central Library at the Wolf Performance Hall on January 23rd. I'm actually emceeing a documentary called Killer at Large, and it's about our current obesity epidemic. And on January 25th, everyone remember, we're doing the public participation meeting at Centennial Hall at 7 p.m. on fluoride. And my nutrition boot camp is throughout the month of February as well, every Saturday afternoon.